I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, we reported that we're in a loneliness crisis in America. Well, what does that mean? There are rigorous scientific studies that show us that chronic social isolation is bad for your health. Its impact has been compared to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. One large study shows that for the most socially isolated people, they were 50% more likely to die from any cause during a 10-year period. So why is that? What's happening to the brain when you don't interact with other people in a real person-to-person space? Why does your brain crave seeing other human faces? How can having simple, friendly conversations give your brain and your body a boost? We're going to hear about why brains need friends. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On October 2nd, 1959, the iconic TV series The Twilight Zone premiered. The first episode was called Where Is Everybody? It was written by Rod Serling and starred Earl Holliman. It was about a man who explored this deserted town, and he has this nervous breakdown because he's so alone. The story's payoff is when we realize it's all been a hallucination. He's actually an astronaut, and he's been in this experiment for over 484 hours to determine what happens during a long space flight alone. So here we have it. We've known for a very long time that people need people in order to function. If people are left alone, they break down. So now, though, we are finding out why. Ben Ryan, Ph.D., has written the book Why Brains Need Friends, The Neuroscience of Social Connection. He's an award-winning neuroscientist, chief science officer at the Mind Science Foundation, a Stanford University lecturer, and a professor at the University of Buffalo. And Ben Ryan, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So what happens to us when we don't interact with other people for long periods?
Well, you know, the introduction you gave there with the reference to that episode, you know, you can kind of imagine being there, walking around a deserted world, feeling the emptiness and the loneliness of that. And I think for most people, that scenario causes a tightening of the chest, you know, a little bit of a elevated heart rate. It feels like stress. I mean, that's how it feels to me. The thought of coming home and finding nobody around is scary. And that's actually exactly what the science basically suggests, is that being isolated triggers a stress response in the body. And actually, I was smiling when you were explaining that, because one of the studies that looked at the stress response was actually done at a NASA space station, and they were isolating people in this sort of confinement area reminiscent of that episode, although not with the simulation going on in their brain. But what they find is that when humans are isolated, we show a rise in the stress hormone cortisol. And what can happen is, as we remain isolated for a long time, this triggers this like chronic stress response in the body, which is very bad. I mean, we know that being stressed all the time is not good for us. There are biological pathways and mechanisms that can explain this and what it does to your body. But one of the key big ones that seems to be driving some of these health effects associated with isolation is inflammation. That when we experience chronic stress, it can basically disrupt this one system in the body that typically tones down inflammation, and that can then lead to a rise in inflammation and chronic inflammation, and that gets in the way of all these bodily systems, including the brain. And I mean, then it just hits the fan. You know, things can go very badly. And you mentioned in the introduction, or a few minutes ago, that isolated people are at up to 50% higher risk of death by any cause. And I think this chronic inflammation issue is one of the many problems that are kind of just taking our organs and putting them at a disadvantage. And then when we experience something like a heart attack, when we experience something like a stroke, the likelihood that we can recover quite as well is vastly diminished. So this, but there's a lot of science to get into here, a lot of neuroscience, and I'm happy to dive into any area you want to explore.
Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to tell us about maybe a time you were very isolated, how did that impact you? What do you do in order to avoid loneliness? And how does that impact you? Or how do you reach out to other people? How important do you feel this is to you? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Ben, one time I was living in Mexico City by myself, and I was there months and months, and I didn't have any friends before I'd met any people and had done anything. And I was, you know, working and trying to, you know, make a life there, and very lonely. But I would, like, be walking down the street, and I would have these auditory hallucinations of, like, my dad calling me in the noise of Mexico City, or I would hear my friends or things. So it was like my brain needed that so badly that it was creating that for me. Wow. Is that normal? Was I just going crazy?
Well, I mean, there's a few things there. One, I think the brain is very social. It's a very, very social organ. And so it tends to look for social information wherever it can. You know, like there's those, we've all experienced, you're in a dark room and you see something like a shadow move. And for a moment, you're certain that is the outline of a person, right? You think it's definitely, oh, I definitely saw the whites of the eyes in the dark. But then it turns out that it's, you know, a glass of water with, you know, a light reflecting off of it. Our brains tend to fill in social information and look. So in a, you know, in ambient noise, it's very possible that your brain could find something meaningful, socially meaningful, especially when it's craving interaction like that. But it's also possible, I mean, there are studies on prisoners who have been held in solitary confinement. And one of the more common outcomes of that is actually hallucinations. So depending on how badly isolated you were during that time, that may have been something going on there too. But I wanted to bring up solitary confinement because you had mentioned, you know, in 1959, this episode came out. Humans have known way longer before then that isolation is bad, because solitary confinement has been used for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years. And, you know, it began kind of being studied here in America in like the 1800s, I believe. And when they started actually documenting it, they realized how bad it really was, that, you know, prisoners were basically mutilating themselves and doing anything to avoid being held in isolation, that they would actually rather, you know, do awful things to themselves than be held alone. And by the way, I'm sorry, I am here with my dog who has a little bit to say, so apologies for that.
Yeah, I'm going to get to dogs in a second, but yeah, I have some ideas, questions about dogs. Yeah, but we know that solitary confinement does terrible things to people. It's considered torture in some parts of mm-hmm. the world, and but yet we do it, and we know that. So the brain, does the brain shrink when you go through something like that physically?
So it won't shrink directly, at least not in a short period of time. I mean, there are studies showing that people who live more social lives have larger brains. and I think that what's happening there is, in putting it very briefly, socializing is really good for our brains. It stimulates the brain. It's like an exercise for the brain. And so like a muscle, it kind of builds up extra brain tissue. And but what happens as we get older, typically, is our brains shrink naturally. And so what I think is happening there is that the socializing is sort of strengthening and sustaining the brain and keeping it from shrinking as we age. But if you were to put someone in you know, solitary confinement for a year, unless they were very old, they wouldn't necessarily show a shrinking of the brain. But what they would probably show is a rise in the risk, or, you know, very much dramatic increase in anxiety and depression. They would become at higher risk of dementia, higher risk of heart failure, higher risk of diabetes. They would actually probably show a lower pain tolerance as well. And maybe most importantly, a very dramatic rise in the risk of suicide. In fact, there are studies on prisoners who were held in solitary confinement that in the year after their release, they were 24% more likely to die by any cause in the year after, but it was like 80% when it comes to suicide. So very dramatic.
We got to take a break here. So we know the impact of isolation, but yet we've built a society that's kind of creating this interconnected isolation. We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the need that we have, the craving. It is as much as nutrition, the oxygen that we breathe. We need other people, as the finding of the new book, Why Brains Need Friends, The Neuroscience of Social Connection. And we're speaking with the author, Ben Rhein. And let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. And John, hey, John, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question is basically, I just finished a 5,000-mile camping in my car trip, and I'm pretty much by myself. But I do have my lucky love with me sleeping in the passenger seat. My question is, does having a dog as a companion, is he a lifesaver in many other levels or ways regarding my loneliness? Because I camp by myself and boondock. And when I'm in cities and stuff, I really don't want to get involved with a lot of people.
All right, John, thank you for that great question. Ben Rhein.
Oh, great question, John. Yeah, I'm a dog lover myself. I love traveling with my dog as well. And that partially is because there is a lot of evidence that dogs can basically trigger the same brain systems that socializing with humans can. It's actually quite amazing. You know, we all know that socializing with dogs, or playing with dogs, whatever you might want to call it, is, you know, feels good. We feel better, usually. And there's a ton of evidence for that, too, that being around dogs, you know, drives release of, like, dopamine, endorphins, lowers our heart rate, has all these great benefits for our health and well-being. But also, the sort of the key when it comes to why socializing is good for us comes down to oxytocin. And perhaps many people have heard of oxytocin and that it's like this love hormone. It bonds us together, and it does that, absolutely. But the other thing about oxytocin is that it has all of these benefits for our health. It's been shown to be like anti-inflammatory, neuroprotective. It can support the function of the immune system. It can support bone growth. It has all these great benefits for us. So when we're socializing and connecting and that oxytocin is flowing, that's really important for our health. Now, the reason I bring that up is because there's evidence that dogs also trigger oxytocin release. And so, it's amazing to think that socializing with your dog or playing with your dog can have that same sort of benefit. And I actually strongly encourage for people who are isolated, and especially for the elderly who are often very alone and struggle to get out of the house, I really recommend spending time with dogs or having a dog, because I actually think it can replace some of the connection that we've been missing for our brains.
This is an internet fact. That means I read it on the internet, and I don't know if it's true. That one of the big differences between a dog and a wolf biologically is that a dog, they have muscles at the lower of their eyelids, and that they can open their eyes wider below in order to show more of the whites of their eyes in order to have bigger eyes for humans to have that feeling of being able to relate to.
Yes, that is both an internet fact and a real fact. So that muscle is actually called the levator anguli oculi medialis. I at one time memorized that, and now I have to use it because why else would I have memorized it? That is a real fact, though, and dogs don't have that ability to do those puppy eyes. In fact,
wolves don't.
Not only, I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you. Wolves do not. Dogs do, which suggests that at some point in their domestication, dogs evolved this muscle to appear cuter to humans so that we would select them and bring them into our lives and feed them the delicious little canned food we give them. And there's actually real modern day evidence of that, too, that they looked at dogs in shelters and how quickly they were adopted. And they found that dogs who activated that muscle more often when meeting with, you know, potential parents, were much more likely to be adopted quicker. So it actually has been shown to basically do what it did evolutionarily. It made dogs be chosen by us because it makes them cuter. So that is absolutely true. And also, by the way, dogs, when they look into our eyes, they show that oxytocin release that I just mentioned, and so do we, so it's mutual, and wolves do not. So that system that I just described that makes dogs so valuable for our health is also something new that they picked up in their process of being domesticated by us.
And they've shown petting your dog will lower your blood pressure. So
that's right.
Let's go to Nancy on the phones. And Nancy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, y'all. Thank you for this call. I've just arrived at a friend's place where I have pet sit before for five dogs. It's a little much all at once, but hey, I'm calling because I have experienced chronic inflammation, I think related to the stress of caregiving both of my parents for 9 years, and I was the primary one. I have sisters, so I guess I felt a little alone in the caregiving thing. And what are best remedies for inflammation? I follow a very healthy diet. I do yoga 4 or 5 times a week, and still I have the experience of inflammation in my joints, and I don't want it to affect my organs. What do I do?
All right, Nancy. So we're not able to give medical advice. We can't really tell you what to do or prescribe anything for you. We can only speak in really general terms. And Ben Ryan, you're not an MD, but is there anything you can tell us?
I mean, there's a couple things. One, I mean, my strongest recommendation is truly socialize, you know, find ways to drive that oxytocin release. So I don't mean just, you know, go to the bar and stand around and, you know, just be, you know, I mean, real meaningful interaction, find the connections that make you feel that, oh my gosh, wow, I feel loved. I feel supported by my community. I mean, that really would be my strongest recommendation, especially in a time where, if you're caring for your parents, you're dealing with a lot of stress, you may be dealing with some sort of grief around that as well, and the loneliness. I mean, those are the times in life where connection is really the most important. The second thing I want to say about inflammation is that inflammation is unfortunately one of those things that's been sort of co-opted by the internet as like the catch-all. Whenever there's like a culprit, like, oh, this is bad for you, well, it's because of inflammation. And so when it comes to reducing inflammation, I would recommend consulting your physician and talking to them and being wary of any remedies and elixirs you find on the internet, because there are probably many that have not been validated.
So we talked about dogs evolving to manipulate humans. Why did humans evolve to have this need to be with other people? There are other species that are solitary. They don't want to be with their own kind, like tigers and cougars and things like that. So why do people need other people?
Oh, it's because we're so good at working together, actually. You know, it's funny, so much of how our brains and bodies work really doesn't have much to do with current life. It has a lot to do with the world that we kind of grew up in, like in an ancient world, evolutionarily. And like a great example of this is like sugar. Like, does sugar actually taste good? Or do our brains just tell us it tastes good because it's like a very pure source of fuel to fuel your muscles and your brain cells? It's probably that one. It's that, like, and for the same reason, our brains tell us that poop doesn't smell good because it's there's all this bacteria. You do not want to eat that. It's bad for you. So our bodies and brains are really designed and built in a way that encourages our survival. They put us in position to best survive. And like I said, humans survive really, really well in groups. We have such advanced capabilities when it comes to working together. In fact, you mentioned the whites of the eyes of dogs. In humans, we all know, of course, you look at someone's eyes, there's the white part you can see. That's called the sclera. That's not typically white for most animals. If you look at, you know, other animals' eyes, they don't have that. But that makes it so much easier for us to see where someone is looking. And that is an incredible adaptive skill that you can look in someone's face and just know where they're looking and see the facial expression on their face.
And the eyebrows.
Right. And yes, exactly. The eyebrows tell you what they're feeling. There's just so much information you can get from just looking at someone's face. You can pretty much tell what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And it's things like that that make us so good at working together, because it makes us effective at hunting. It makes us effective at defending ourselves. It makes us effective at communicating and understanding and team working. And so over time, you know, our brains really have realized, I guess evolutionarily, we have been shaped in a way so that we want to be around each other, that we have these built-in systems in our brains that make us feel good when we're around others. And actually, oxytocin is a key part of that. You know, I mentioned that that's sort of the neurotransmitter that is like glue, it binds us together. Oxytocin has been shown to stimulate dopamine release. So dopamine is, you know, this reinforcement, you know, sort of feel good, but really more like, this is good for you. You should come back and do this more often. So our brains have these reward systems, social reward systems built into them, that when we have positive, pleasant social experiences, we feel that sense of community. It tells us, oh yeah, this is good for your health. It's like, it, you know, you eat sugar, you have that pleasant dopamine release. It's really kind of the same thing. It's your brain telling you this is going to support you in surviving. And what's fascinating too, as you mentioned, solitary animals are actually wired the exact opposite, that when they're in groups, they show that stress response that humans show when we're isolated. So if you put a bunch of tigers together, they start to show a rise in cortisol, which again suggests that they are similarly wired to live in the conditions that are best for their survival. And they're really good at hunting on their own. So their brains tell them, don't be around each other, be alone. You're going to survive just well, just fine this way. And it's really amazing, all the systems built into us that kind of just don't really matter anymore, but they do still influence our health every single day.
But I'm sure there are plenty of people listening right now who are thinking, actually, if I think about going out and meeting people, I start feeling stress. I get the cortisol thinking about hanging out with other people. I'm an introvert. I don't want to, you know, meet other people. I'd rather be stay home.
Yeah. Well, there's, again, there's kind of two directions on this. One is pretty much everybody experiences that that feeling. We have, unfortunately, I have a whole chapter on this in the book talking about these bad predictions that the brain makes socially. And to the introverts listening who are like, no, like, I actually don't like going out. We'll get to you in a second. But for the average person, when you think about, you know, is it worth it to go out and meet friends on a Friday night? You know, is it worth it to have a conversation with someone? You generally feel like it's not going to be worth it. I'm not going to get much out of it. They're probably not going to really want to interact with me. They're not going to like me as much as I want them to. We have all of these bad predictions that lead us away from interaction. And so bottom line, social anxiety is very normal. It's very common. But it's a little bit like exercise, right? It's like we know that going to the gym takes energy. So does going to the dinner party. But once you're there and you're exercising, you think, man, you know, I'm really glad I did this. And I think oftentimes that happens with socializing. And so it's really important to force yourself to kind of get over that barrier, because when you do succumb to the couch and TV on Friday night instead of going to the dinner party, it's actually, you know, not only going to be less satisfying, but it's also probably going to be worse for your health. But when it comes to the introverts who truly do not want to go out, this is a longer discussion, but briefly, everyone has different social needs. That's absolutely true. Some people are more extroverted and they basically are like I like to use an analogy of a plant that needs water. Extroverts are like a plant that just soaks up water. They need to be watering all the time. And the water is the analogy for the interaction. Introverts are like what's like a snake plant? Is that what it's called? Where they only need to be watered like once a month and they're perfectly happy. That's entirely okay. It's perfectly okay to not be socializing that often if that's what your brain kind of needs, if that's what your preferences are. But the key is to make sure that you're not letting the plant dry out, that you're not letting the soil get totally dry, because I think that is where the health consequences start to come in. And I worry that for introverts, it's easier to get there and stay there because of that that kind of disinterest in going out and that feeling of stress. So there's a lot to get into with this whole discussion.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you need some contact. You need some people in your life. And we'll talk more about how much. I mean, you can have too much water could kill a plant. You know, so what's the right amount for you? Are you an introvert? Are you an extrovert? I think we're always somewhere balancing in between, and it can change from day to day, occasion to occasion. How do you navigate this? How do you recharge? And it is like a muscle and can be exhausted. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is probably good information to have as we go into the holidays and we're going to be meeting a lot of people. And, you know, how do you make the most out of those events? Because brains need friends, and this is an opportunity to recharge that brain. 833-877-8255. The Source continues after this break.
As you reflect on the causes that matter to you this holiday season, consider supporting TPR. Throughout 2025, you relied on us for fair-minded journalism and thoughtful programming. Now, with federal funding for public media gone, your support is essential to keep TPR strong in the year ahead. Whether you make a one-time gift or become a sustaining supporter, you help ensure this service continues. Give online at tpr.org today.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Your brain needs friends. That means you need friends. You need social interaction. You need to see real people in real spaces, as Zoom is not enough. These are some of the findings from the book, Why Brains Need Friends, The Neuroscience of Social Connection. Ben Rain is the PhD. He's the author of the book. And you can call him with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So is Zoom good enough, Ben? Your brain is looking at a 3D space that's been flattened. It's just right. Not the same thing. It's very controlled. It's not like a real interaction.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, basically what the data on this, what the studies have shown, is that when it comes to how good people feel after having an interaction, in person is the best. There's no doubt about it. However, being on Zoom, a video call is probably the second best. And the less lifelike it gets, like when you go to a phone call or text message, which is very far from being lifelike, the benefits go progressively down. They kind of go away. And, it's interesting because it makes sense. If you think about it this way, that when we socialize, I mentioned earlier, you know, you can read someone's facial expressions. You can just tell what they're thinking based on their eyes, based on their eyebrows. Of course, the tone of their voice, their body language. There's so much rich information embedded in our conversations and interactions, and our brains just sponge that up. That's kind of why I said also earlier that socializing is like an exercise for the brain. It's like you're doing so much, you're processing so much information. But when you go to a video call, even, you know, you go to the first step down away from in person, you can still see each other. Sure, you can still hear each other. But what you can't do is you can't make eye contact. You can't smell each other, which I know may sound weird, but our brains are kind of doing this in the background.
I mean, pheromones are a thing. So yeah.
Yep. Picking up on these social odors. And you also lose a little bit of body language. You can't really see the lower body. Usually, you know, there's not a whole lot you can see.
See, the hands are very important.
Hands are definitely, yeah, but usually you can't see. I mean, unless you're standing 6 yards away from your screen, most people, you can't see their legs, which can tell information too. You know, they're crossing their legs. Like, what are they doing there? So you lose a little bit of that information. You go to a phone call, you lose even more. You lose the facial expressions. You lose some, you know, even seeing where they're looking with their eyes. Down to a text message, now you can't even hear their tone of voice. And what I think is happening here is, you know, I mentioned that when we socialize, our brains have these social reward systems that make us feel good. Well, how do our brains know I am socializing with another human? It's from all that texture. It's from all those social cues. So as you progressively strip away all of those facial expressions and vocal tone and you flatten the interaction down to just text, there's less information there telling your brain, this is an interaction. You're around others.
That's why people use emojis. And emojis are the very simplified human face.
That's right. And, you know, I propose in the book that emojis may be actually useful because there's some evidence that people looking at emojis show brain responses similar to if they were looking at the actual human facial expression. So perhaps through emojis, we can restore a little bit of that texture if you have to have a text message. But so my advice on this, by the way, is if you are talking to someone and it's a text message, see if you can call them on the phone. If you're going to call them on the phone, see if you can do a Zoom instead. See whatever information you can add back, if you can kind of level up. And of course, ideally, if it's a Zoom call and you're in the same city, can you meet in person? Wherever you have the opportunity to get closer to being lifelike, that would be my recommendation.
And like those experiments with monkeys and the surrogate mothers, and they break it down into the most basic, you know, what does that mother figure look like? They give them a doll. And it's, that's what reminds me of those emojis, you know, trying to just give you the basic emotional information you need for context of what that is. Is this person being sarcastic or are they being mean to me? I don't know. Let's go to a caller, Henrietta. And Henrietta, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I did recognize all that he was saying because I also use voice tonation and body language as part of my training as being a hypnotist. And I recharge myself. I go out, and then all of a sudden I'm there with I see a person, and then I always find something good to tell them. And then I just said, you know, and we just have a conversation because I don't tell them what I do. And then all of a sudden, I feel like they open up. And then I tell myself, well, how can I help you when they let me know of their concern? But it also makes me feel happy, so not to ever feel sorry for myself, to keep working and trying hard to serve God and assist the people who are having this social trauma or whatever it is.
All right, Henrietta, thank you for that. So I guess people can get better at these things, particularly if they have a little bit of training, Ben.
Yeah, you know, I wanna applaud you, Henrietta, because that's amazing. I mean, the world needs more people like you who are not afraid to go up to someone to say, you know, give them a compliment, start a conversation. Because first off, when that happens to you, it's such an incredible feeling of just. It's like a surprise. It's like a surprise from the universe of like, oh wow, my community cares about me and I didn't know I had this friend that was out there. But also that's probably very good for your health, Henrietta, because there's a lot of evidence that interacting with strangers and just starting conversations just like you're doing is really, really good for us and can benefit our mood, can benefit our health. And you know, the question that you had there was about can it be trained? I mean, in my experience, there's absolutely this kind of barrier to interaction. But the more you practice the skill of connecting with people and just socializing and just trying to start a conversation, it absolutely gets better. And one of the things I love to do, similarly to you, Henrietta, is when I'm at those like kind of awkward conference kind of events where there's like a bunch of high top tables and everyone's just kind of standing around. You could picture you walk in and you don't know anybody. Nobody knows anybody. Everyone's just kind of standing around clustering awkwardly. I like to stand near the door and grab a table. And when people come in, I invite them over and say, hey, why don't you come over here and talk with us? And I just keep on growing the table and saving everybody coming through the door from that awkward dance of like, oh, I have to pick a table and find these random people. And when you do that, it creates such an incredible interaction, way better than going up to a random table and trying to start a conversation, because people like to be welcomed in and invited. And so that's such a great habit. And I once again applaud you.
Another caller, let's go to Eva. Eva, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Eva. First of all, thanks for having me on. So I'm German. I was born and raised in Germany, lived in the United States for almost 30 years now. And I think it's also a big cultural influence on that, because I was raised to where if you're like, for example, at the store, you're in line, you just keep to yourself. But I've noticed that coming over here in the United States, you go to the grocery store, you're in line, and a total stranger starts talking to you randomly, like they've known you forever. And that's so bizarre for me, because I think to myself, like, I don't know this person. And it's just also how I was raised, and that's just the culture. And I have friends that tell me, oh, you're such an introvert. But I think to myself, no, I'm not really. It's just I was raised differently. So I wanted to know or curious how much culture-wise there is impact or influence. And I'll take my answer off.
Wow, Eva, that's great. So in San Antonio, when you stand in line at Luby's, you know, waiting to get your tray. It's a long line. By the time you finally get up and start getting your entree, everyone knows each other and is talking to each other. So I know exactly what you're talking about. So what about cultural differences, Ben?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely huge cultural differences. I actually, a couple of years ago, gave a talk in Iceland and found that Icelandic folks are very kind of reserved and quiet. And I was talking to some of the people working at the facilities, and this one girl actually said, she's like, you are very, like, strangely social. Like, we are not used to this kind of American personality here. And I apologize. I'm sorry if it's overbearing. There's no question about it. There's cultural differences. I mean, I think it's actually quite interesting to think that if you trace the line all the way back to our, like, ancient origins, that our brains want us to be around each other for the sake of survival. And now we've gotten so far from any sort of evolutionary pressures on us, right? We dominate the earth. We shape the environment around us instead of letting it shape us. And we've built our own cultures, and we've kind of forgotten about the importance of connection, you know? And that's actually kind of why I wrote this whole book, is that I don't think it's being prioritized in the same way on a health level, or being recognized on a health level, the way that we think about exercise and diet and sleep and all these great things that are good for us. And it's like, that's actually kind of a little bit like what I'm up against with this neuroscience research, where it's like, look, the brain is better off when we connect, but you're kind of like punching into this glass wall of culture, that it's a little bit weird if you talk to someone at the grocery store, even here in the United States. I mean, you can definitely have not a great experience with that, depending on how you do it. But, you know, I wish that those cultural or sort of like social barriers that we've put in place, where you think, this person probably doesn't want to be bothered, I wish we had a little bit less of that, because I do actually think we'd be a healthier and definitely more connected culture. And I think especially nowadays, where, you know, it feels like we're less connected. Not only the data show that we are more isolated, but it just feels like we're experiencing less community, definitely here in the United States. And I think some more of that could, you know, really make a big difference.
Do you think that in cultures where people aren't so gabby, that they have some impact?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, like, condemn any culture to, like, poorer health, but I know that there is evidence that, like, you look at blue zones, for example, right? These places where people are, they
live a long
outstanding
time.
Health. Yeah, one of the things that makes them so healthy is that they have great, strong communities. They connect together. They spend a lot of time together. And similarly, you know, there's recent evidence showed that these super agers, which are very similar to this blue zone concept, they're these people that they live very long, and in their 80s they are very sharp, you know, they're as sharp as people in their 60s. They also socialize more. So I don't want to say that, you know, not socializing is going to hurt you, but it does seem like socializing more and connecting more with their communities is a good thing.
Okay, take another break. Jennifer, I'll get you on the air when we come back. Our number is 833-877-8255. The Source and Your Brain Needs Friends when we come back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking with Ben Rhein. He's the author of Why Brains Need Friends, The Neuroscience of Social Connection. He's a chief science officer at the Mind Science Foundation. Let's go to Jennifer on the phones. And Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for discussing this subject. I was wondering if you were going to touch on how absolutely diabolical the government response to COVID was. They made people isolate themselves, and then when they were, quote-unquote, allowed to gather, they were supposed to cover their face so that they couldn't read facial cues from each other. It seems like that would create a stress level that made everyone more apt to get sick.
All right, Jennifer, thank you for your question. So I don't think it was a diabolical response. We were dealing with a pandemic and a tragedy, and decisions were made, not necessarily the best ones, but, you know, I think everyone did the best they could. Ben Rhein, what's your answer to Jennifer?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the isolation associated with COVID that we all experienced had effects, right, and detrimental effects. And, you know, we all lived through it. We all remember the feeling. At the very beginning of this, I mentioned, you know, imagine what it would be like to live in a world where nobody exists. We all kind of went through that, right? And it was stressful. It did feel bad. I mean, you know, weighing the health effects of everyone's individual and isolation against the very much unknown at the time health effects of COVID, very difficult to compare and, you know, we're talking about a viral outbreak versus a sort of circumstantial effect.
But
of life.
People didn't really know what you were. This is why your book is important, because maybe if they had considered what you have in your book, that you know, we would have addressed it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there would have been a different response, probably, and I think probably maybe public health officials would have addressed this more head on, because yeah, I mean, what COVID did was it created a very good opportunity for scientists to study the effects of isolation, actually, and we learned a lot about that. Yes, it is bad for us, and even in modern day, when we are super connected through social media, through Zoom, whatever it may be, we still can hurt from being left alone. And yeah, but I mean, one thing I do worry about with the sort of long-term effects of the COVID isolation is that I think when we all remember when we went into isolation and we all noticed, our brains noticed, holy cow, we're not seeing our friends anymore. This is a dramatic change in our social lives, because that's what our brains do. We look for the patterns in the world around us and we settle into comfortable, you know, expectations. And then when those patterns change, our brains take note. And so we remember that huge dip in interaction, but then we stayed there for a while. And after such a long time of being isolated, I actually think that when the world opened again and we had the chance to interact, our brains had adjusted their expectations to basically a social interaction level of zero. So even going out once a month felt like way more than we're used to. And I worry that we actually haven't really rebounded fully ever since that, because we got so used to spending Friday nights on the couch and, you know, Saturdays at home instead of out and about. So I think there could be long-term changes, behavioral trends, based on those few years of really deep solitude.
Should there be a response to that? Should we be looking for ways to try to bring people together?
Yeah, I mean, I think social gatherings, right? I mean, obviously, duh, it feels like a silly answer, but you know, I'm the chief science officer of the Mind Science Foundation, which is in San Antonio. And before COVID, you know, there were a lot of in-person events, a lot of talks and, you know, science talks and things like that. And then, of course, during COVID, it all went to virtual. And then ever since that, there's really been a lot of this discussion of like, how do we get people in person again? Because people want to be in person, but I think maybe a lot of organizations can relate to this. It's hard to get people in person because, you know, it's like there's this desire to get out and do things. But then there's always that last minute barrier of like, the couch looks pretty comfortable tonight. It's been a long work week, right? So I don't know. It's like, I that's kind of actually also why I wrote this book, is because I want the average reader, you know, that you don't have to have a PhD in neuroscience to understand my book. It's all very, very clear and the science is made incredibly accessible, because I want people to read about it and understand, oh, when I make that decision on Friday night to sit at home, this is what's happening inside of my brain. This is what's happening inside of my body. And I think perhaps if people are equipped with that knowledge, they might be just a little bit more likely to step out and see their friends and hopefully find that, yes, actually, it does feel pretty good.
Let's go to Sarah on the phone. Sarah, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thanks so much. Love your show. I work with kids and I have two of my own, and I've noticed that they initiate friendships and relationships usually online, and that is their preference. They don't want to be social or in person, and that's oftentimes more comfortable, and it seems to become more prevalent. And so I'm very curious your thoughts on if we need to push them into more social realms, or if it's just we're going to have to start accepting and figuring out what a world of online relationships looks like versus a world of in-person relationships.
Sarah, thank you for that very, very good call. Appreciate that. Ben Ryan.
Great question. You know, it kind of depends a little bit on the age. So there is evidence that in our early years, like the first, you know, couple of years of life, up to maybe 5, 6, 7, around there, our brains are especially sensitive to social information, in just the same way that, you know, children can learn a language really quick because they have all this plasticity in their brains. They can just soak up information. It's very much the same for social information. And during that period, you learn things like empathy. You learn how, you know, to approach interactions and not violate other people's boundaries and make friends. And, you know, how does the world react to you? And what I worry about is if those interactions don't occur, or they occur in virtual settings, then maybe that, you know, someone's not going to form the same sort of social understanding. There's actually evidence that the prefrontal cortex, this part of the brain that does a lot of like social thinking, you know, trying to, like when you're looking at someone's facial expression and trying to figure out what they're thinking, that's the prefrontal cortex. That brain area seems to be shaped and developed by social interaction in early life. And while there is that sensitive period in the first few years of life, that definitely, that trend of shaping the brain continues, you know, through the teenage years, through adolescence. And I do actually worry a little bit about how much social time teens are spending in these virtual environments, because as we discussed earlier, it's not the same. It's not giving your brain that same information. And so I think there's probably less to learn there. But I don't know, the counter argument there is, well, if this is sort of the world we're trending towards, then maybe learning how to communicate in virtual environments is helpful, because that's the interactions you're going to be
exposed
to.
I call that interconnected isolation. They are still isolated, but they're connected to other people. And like you made the comparison to sugar before, and how, you know, your body craves sugar, and therefore it created this sweet sensation when we consume it. That's kind of like the junk food. You know, you can't all just eat sugar. And so I'm wondering if this type of interaction is more of a junk food sort of socialization.
Yeah, I would say the true junk food of socialization is like watching like reality TV shows, like Real Housewives on Bravo, right? You're like, you're watching people argue, you're getting this intense, dramatic social interaction without being a part of it. That's probably the closest thing to that. But I think what is absolutely true, actually, the caller, Sarah, I believe you said that the kids prefer it because it's easier. I definitely think that's true. I actually published this hypothesis that I call the virtual disengagement hypothesis. The name is irrelevant. The theory is that we don't engage as much empathy when interacting online. In other words, we don't take on the other person's emotions quite as strongly because, of course, you can't see their emotions. You can't see their face. And that this is, you know, a good example of this is it's way easier to deliver bad news to someone via text than even via phone call or of course, in person. It's just
but it's also less risk involved. And no pun intended, but you have less skin in the game.
Right. Yeah. And so I think, you know, when for kids trying to make friends, you're worried about social rejection. You're worried about, you know, mishandling things. It's a lot easier digitally because you're not there. You're not in person. And if you do something wrong, you don't have to feel quite as bad. But it's important to have those experiences because you would do something wrong, you say something wrong, you hurt someone's feelings, you see the look on their face. As a young person, that teaches you a lot. That shapes your brain and shows you, hey, that's not okay to do to someone. Don't do it again. And I worry about what happens without that.
Let's go to Ray. And Ray, we're short on time, but we're getting you on the air. Ray, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. This is kind of an overlap. Thank you for the program and the doctor. Do mirror neurons have anything whatsoever to do with how we identify with characters on TV or in the movies?
All right, thank you, Ray. And Ben?
Oh, good question. You know, mirror neurons, so they have a little bit to do with empathy, I think. They actually, well, they have a good amount to do with empathy, which is that kind of relating and sharing someone's experience. So when you see a character's emotion on screen and you feel that same way, then that's kind of partially mirror neurons. But there is evidence that the level of this sort of empathy brain activity we experience and how much you take on someone's emotions can differ depending on the person, depending on the situation, of course. And it seems like actually the most impactful thing that if for determining that is how much you see yourself as an overlap with that person. What is your self-other overlap? You think about like a Venn diagram where you're one circle and they're the other. If there's like a 100% overlap, those empathy-related brain areas, some of which have mirror neurons, will activate more. And mirror neurons are actually more involved in like basic like understanding, like physical understanding. You see someone pick up a glass and, mm-hmm. and you can imagine picking up the glass more so than like taking on their emotions.
Ben Rhine, PhD, the Chief Science Officer at the Mind Science Foundation. Thank you, Tom Slick, based in San Antonio. His book is Why Brains Need Friends, The Neuroscience of Social Connection. And I think we made a social connection today, Ben. Thanks for coming on the air.
I think so, too. Thank you so much for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.